Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Aquarium. I'm Jerry Schubel, and it's great to have all of you here this evening. And before I introduce our speaker, I want to acknowledge our sponsor, Gazette Newspapers. And I also hope that if you haven't noticed some new photographs that are hanging out in the Great Hall and around in the preview gallery, because they were taken by our speaker this evening, Jim Hellman. Jim Hellman is going to talk to us about the portrait of a coral reef. He's an amazing photographer. He's an imaging specialist who creates high-resolution underwater landscapes of coral reefs and underwater environments around the world. And his career peaked when he did the kelp glass in our gift shop. He transformed this aquarium for all time, and it set the tone for the big expansion that we want to do out front, and I think you made our job much easier by doing what you did for us. He uses specialized lighting and multiple images to capture wide views of marine life. His life-size image of Bloody Bay Wall in the Cayman Islands, portrait of a coral reef, appeared in the October 2001 issue of National Geographic. And he's going to tell us some of the story also of this kelp glass. Broke the law. It's really quite a remarkable feat to create images like that, especially off California where water quality doesn't always cooperate and you can have, it's not like doing it in the Caribbean or some other tropical environments. He has produced high resolution images though in the Caribbean, the Sulu Sea, the Celebes Sea, and he has had an exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. It was part of an exhibit on bioluminescence and fluorescence called Creatures of Light. And that exhibit moved to the Field Museum in Chicago in last month sometime. And some of his pictures are up now in the Great Hall. Others will go up tomorrow, and you should take a look at them, and you should go in, and if you haven't, take a look at the gift shop and look at it from the outside. And it's a magnificent thing. And Jim, we thank you for everything you've done for us. Please join me in welcoming Jim Hellman.
I'd like to thank the Aquarium of the Pacific for a couple of things. One, for giving me this tremendous opportunity to do something that I've wanted to do for a long time, and that is create a really special image of a California coral reef, which I call a kelp forest. When I was asked if I could do this last year, I was very excited, very honored, and a little bit scared. It wasn't something that I was sure that I could do, but I really wanted to, and it's been on my mind for about 15 years, because this is an environment in California that I grew up with. I learned to dive in my 20s here in San Diego, and the kelp forests were the first introduction I had to the ocean. In trying to visualize how to do one of these images, it always involves a lot of techniques that I need to come up with and experiment with, and this is really, like Jerry said, it was the epitome of this type of image. For me, it was something I put off for a long time because of the sheer difficulty of it. So what they asked for was an image that would cover this span of windows on the new addition. And technically, what that means is I need to produce some kind of an image that can be reproduced 125 feet wide by 13 feet high. That's over 1,300 square feet. That's a lot of imagery. What it means is if you reproduce an image at photographic quality, you want something like 100 pixels per inch. And this is 160 by 1,500 images, or what amounts to 2.4 gigapixels or 2,400 megapixels. That's a bunch of images taken with a 12 megapixel camera. Underwater, this is what you get with a 12 megapixel camera. And that's a pretty high-resolution camera for what you take underwater these days. But you can get bigger ones, so we could go to 21. Or the camera I ended up using for this can take 36 megapixels. But even when you do that, that's about the portion of the image that we're covering. So that's where the challenge started. And I can tell you, I'll tell you more about how I went about this later. There are more problems than that, because even if you could have enough resolution in a camera, this is how close you need to be to get color. If you back up enough to get more, well, the color goes away and it all gets kind of blurry and we kind of miss the point. If we back up to see the whole kelp forest, we won't see it. And the other problem is kelp moves around a lot, so it's always in motion. And these, for these reasons, about 10 years ago, I decided I would put this off till later. So I did. So the bottom line is, this was a really big challenge for me, and it was something that I felt honored to be asked to do, and I really can't come up with a better place that a resulting image should be except here at the aquarium. So thank you again to the aquarium for asking me to do this. So to give you some background on how I got started, and I'm often asked, well, how do you go about these? Well, they're all different. Every one I do is probably different. And it has a lot of parallels to my career. I started out as an engineer working on R&D projects. This is a railgun worked on in the 80s. But I always did photography, but I did mostly photography of the projects that I worked on. So. And they were usually technical things, like how do you time a photograph to take a picture of the muzzle blast of a gun that's firing? Or how do you take a picture of a bullet in flight fired by that gun that's traveling at about 2,000 kilometers per second? The timing has to be exactly right. And along the way, I had discovered diving. So that was a big influence for me, too. But it didn't really get me into underwater photography, because so many things had been done by that time. But it was a big thing for me to discover more about the underwater world, and it changed my life. It made me realize that there's 70% of this planet that nobody's seen, and that's the new frontier. So I went to work for a company. I had to find something I could do that had to do with the ocean, so I went to work for a company that was making a new type of scanner that used lasers to look through water and could photograph the ocean bottom. And basically, we put this thing in a towed vehicle or an ROV or mounted it to a submarine, and it would get towed along the ocean floor, and it scans a line after a line and builds up an image of the ocean floor. And the real magic of it is, from about 100 feet away, you could photograph an entire airplane wreck. So this was a job I had for a while, because I was on the development team of this device, and I designed the control system, so when it came to use it, I was the only operator, and I got to travel around the world and take pictures with my own little line scanner. They thought it was theirs, but the cool thing about this camera was, if you want to photograph something underwater, or you want to image things underwater, you could use side-scan sonar, which can detect things from a great distance, but you can't see very much resolution. Or you can get up really close, like 5 feet with an ROV, and you can see what something is. But this was a middle ground device that from maybe 150 to 100 feet away could identify an actual item and then go in and investigate it further. So this was used on environmental surveys. It was used on pipeline inspections. I did get around to doing scientific surveys with it, where we were just looking for marine life and particular items of interest, like thermal vents. We were hired by a king crab boat consortium that had multiple boats, and they wanted to make the best of the king crab season. They hired us to go out and try to find the big pockets of crab. And that's what a big pile of king crab looks like. So these are my first underwater pictures, really. I was actually doing some underwater photography during this time, but not much of significance. This was the biggest thing. And this is what it looked like when you were using this device to scan the ocean floor. And we would run big, we'd run line after line to cover an area for some kind of a survey, and ultimately you're trying to locate something or map something. And one of my tasks became trying to do something with this imagery and put it into a form where people can communicate or use it for presentations and that kind of thing. And the goal was to try to put these together in mosaics. And this was at a time when it was kind of a miraculous thing for us to even store the images, because I think this was mostly done on a 286 computer. And this, the emergence of personal computers allowed this technology to be developed, but it was very early, and we didn't have the capability to even store all of the images. So one of the things I was tasked with was taking this diverse type of imagery from side scan sonar or bathymetry maps or line scan data or ROV data and try to correlate it and put it together into mosaics. And I eventually found ways to do that by exactly that, visually correlating the visual references, any true references that I had, and then finding creative ways to scale things back and forth until we could create a large-scale picture of what an area looked like from all the available imagery that we had. And I was fortunate enough to be able to start a company to process this data for them. And so for a while, for several years, I had my own company that I basically focused on digital imaging types of activities, and also went to sea occasionally to do these kinds of projects, and then post-process all this digital data of the oceanographic stuff. And this is where I first started to put different types of imagery together to make one big picture. I also had to find commercial uses for digital imaging, and those were very different. So developing the skills to retouch images and make really big high-resolution images, both used for commercial photography. Like here, I was hired by Intel at one point to create images of the new 486 processor that didn't exist yet. Things like that, to designing kind of run-of-the-mill trade show applications for advertising, where we want to develop graphics that are going to be reproduced very large. So my company both designed the graphics and produced the final prints that made these big displays. Along the way, also was fortunate enough to be able to do more diving. And my wife and I went to Grand Cayman on our honeymoon, and I fell in love with this area in Little Cayman called Bloody Bay Wall. And it was one of my first experiences in a Caribbean environment, a place that had lots and lots of marine life all really packed into a small area. And I was kind of balancing the fact of being amazed by all the different things I saw and also being limited by the small size of the things I could photograph in light. Even in a wide-angle situation, and this is a reef that covers miles and miles of area, and it's just densely packed with solid, these candy-colored sponges and corals, colors 100 feet under the ocean that you would not believe, but you can only photograph stuff that you get 2 feet from. So to take a photograph like this, you need to be 2 feet from your subject. You can only light a certain portion, and you balance that against the blue water exposure to make an exciting image. If you go and try to move back farther, you have big areas that you just can't image because you're getting too far away. If you get farther back, just all the color goes away. If I could back then, I'd take an image like this that showed the whole reef, but you back up enough to photograph what you're trying to photograph, it all goes away. Very frustrating. Well, I was really fortunate at this time for having all of these things come together in my life, where I was able to not only visualize a project to try to photograph outside of what my camera could see, but I was also fortunate enough to be able to have the resources to do it on my own. And so I formed the idea that I could take all of my collected knowledge of putting high-resolution mosaic images together with the existing equipment that I already had, and I might be able to do this with high-resolution images from a coral reef and go back to some place that I'd been before and photograph all these things that I couldn't fit into my camera. So the idea was, if I could take a spot like this that I'd like to photograph and divide it up into cells, and then in each one of those cells get close enough to where I could capture imagery that was 2 feet away, or 3 feet away, and combine them digitally somehow, like I had already done with other things, maybe I could make one huge image. So I formed a project in 1998 to build the equipment that I thought I'd need to do this. I did a bunch of tests in my pool, trying to determine what distance, at what size, with what lens and what optics, that, what field of view, what do I need to, in parameters, to capture what particular cell size in a way that these images could be contained, combined in a way to make something that was both accurate and captured all those true colors, but also was life-size, because you have to do something with it. So my goal was, why not make a life-size reef? So I built this equipment and tested it here in California. And I formed this big project to take this down, chartered a boat for 2 weeks to photograph a section of Great Wall West in Bloody Bay and Cayman Islands. So I'd actually scouted this before, but I had people that I knew there that helped me find the right place of the wall. And in 2 weeks, I photographed this 20-foot by 70-foot area of Great Wall West in about 280 images. If you look at this little cluster of sponges down on the far left corner, that almost fits in one frame. Not quite, but almost. So that gives you an idea of what one frame looks like here. In this, the matrix of images that it took to make this was approximately 22 columns wide and approximately 10 to 15 images high. This whole image, if we pan across it, is 1.7 gigapixels. It's about 22,000 pixels high by 75,000 pixels wide, something in that range. But the whole idea was, we can photograph an area this big and then hopefully reproduce it life-size so that you could walk up to it and explore a coral reef like you were standing in front of it without the water there to take all the good stuff away. So the whole point was to build this. Unfortunately, timing is so much of everything. When I got this project done, I was very excited in August of 2001 because I had gotten the sponsors to build this life-size. I had a venue to do it, and we were actually in production of it. The image was coming out in National Geographic in October that year, and then the following month we were going to have this displayed. Unfortunately, 9/11 happened, and that changed the face of everything. The exhibit where this was going to be displayed was canceled. All my sponsors went away, and it has never been done. So that was a project that has now been put aside, and we were waiting for another supreme opportunity like the Aquarium Pacific here to build something of that magnitude. I did continue on this work, though, and went back to photograph a similar site in the same area in 2003. And incidentally, that image before, at the time it was created, was the first gigapixel image that was ever created. It was the highest resolution digital image ever created. This was the second. Went back and did this in 2003 with the same thing. And also, incidentally, this is all photographed on film. At this point in 1999, and even in 2003, really, we did not have a digital camera solution that was robust enough to do this kind of work. So up to this point, this was all done on film. But my quest actually was a little larger. What I wanted to do is be able to photograph anything, anywhere, underwater, and I had cheated. On the Bloody Bay Wall image, I picked a spot that was a flat plane because, well, it was one of the greatest things I'd ever seen, and I did want to reproduce that, but it was also a flat, sheer plane where everything was a set distance from me and I had a set depth of field. And how to photograph something with unlimited depth of field, that was a big challenge. So I designed more equipment, equipment that I could use myself in different situations. And I spent 5 years working out that little problem. And the culmination of that was in 2007. We actually started this in 2006. I got to the point where I could create one of these images and had a methodology for the how to photograph the different parts of an image that would go together to make this mosaic happen, to faithfully create an image of a coral reef community with unlimited depth of field. It just took me a long time to do it. Luckily, I had built up lots of friends in the Cayman Islands. I could keep going back there over and over again to test my theories and go out and play around. But it did take a long time. It took several years to get to the point where I could pull this off. The culmination of that were these two images that I did in Grand Cayman at a place called Orange Canyon. Right about that time where I'd finally gotten to the point where I thought I could create anything, I was commissioned by a group in Grand Cayman to create an image specially for a building. And this was a project called the Cabana Bay Observation Tower. And they wanted to create a tower that you could walk up, that was a public attraction. You could walk up a staircase and you get to the top and you could see all around the island. But on the way, you walk up a picture of a coral reef. So we worked together to plan this image based on the architecture. And in the end, they decided based on how the traffic would go that they'd like to have a turtle here and a grouper here and a queen angel here and a school of fish here and a stingray there. So I pretty much gave them all of that. I didn't tell them that you don't find stingrays here, so it's an eagle ray instead. But in the end, we produced this image that was big enough to actually print on the side of a building, but they chose to render this image in hand-cut tiny Italian glass tiles. So they spent about $2 million and 3 years having these tiny tiles cut. And when you see this image from a distance of about 15 feet, it looks like a continuous tone image. It looks like the art prints I have of it. And there will be one on the wall out here. But you get up close, and it's this whole different level of art where you see the artistry of the people who cut the tiles. And it's a kind of a magnificent thing that I was very honored to do that will be there for years and years and years. Along this way, I decided, what am I going to do with this? Now I've got to the point, I think I can photograph anything. Well, maybe except a coral, kelp forest. But around this time, in 2004, a scientific paper came out that identified the 13 or 11, depending on which list you look at, of the hotspots of marine biodiversity around the world. These are areas that are important for number of endemic species and endangerment. The number one place in the world is the Philippines. So I decided I would attack this list and start out with area number one, and I went out to start this project. And this is a project that I'll spend the rest of my life on. I can't do these in a month. Some of these places are easy to get to. Some of these places I'll have to figure out how to get to. That was Tubataha in the Philippines. This is a reef in Sipadan in Malaysia. This is also Sipadan. This is a reef on Grand Cayman called Babylon. This is in Indonesia. This is a really great dive in a great reef in Malaysia. This is an area. This is a place called Barracuda Point, and there's actually a couple of images here. I'm not sure if I have the other one on here, but these are huge bumphead rafts, and they drop you in the water at like 6:30 in the morning when it's just starting to get light, and all the fish have been down sleeping in the reef, and all the little ones go around and wake the big ones up, and they all congregate at the top of the reef. And then once they're all ready, they start this migration across the reef to the shallows to feed. So they drop you in the water, and you see huge schools of big-eyed jacks, and then this big school of bumphead wrasse is surrounding you, and you swim across the reef with them. It's a really great experience. This is an area in Baja California, off of Baja California. It's a coral island group. It's 300 miles south of Cabo. These are giant mantas, two different species of mantas at an area called the Boiler. This is the other end of that Barracuda reef shot, where if you continue on with the bumphead wrasse and you go all the way down to the side of the reef, you'll wind up in a big school of thousands of barracuda. And this is a reef on Grand Cayman. This is in Socorro Islands, Mexico. After I'd done a number of these images, my good friend Emery Christoph from National Geographic invited me to come and see some really neat technology at the University of California, San Diego. This group called CalIT2 had developed a lot of different types of visualization systems, including 3D cave environments that you go in and you swear you're walking on the surface of Mars, to these super resolution monitor systems that are made of tiled monitors of different resolutions, all driven by a bank of computers that can treat this all as one monitor. And sometimes it's HD monitors, sometimes it's really high resolution computer monitors. So the screen you just saw was a 280 megapixel monitor. So now I had the real privilege of being able to see a lot of my images at life size there, which I'd never been able to before. So that was a very cool thing. The Geographic was interested in maybe putting some of technology like this in Explorer's Hall and possibly using some of my images. That actually never happened, but they had a great meeting about it. And some of the scientists there at that meeting said, wow, well, he's been in the magazine before. We should send him back and photograph this Great Wall West reef again a decade later, see what it looks like now. So I put together a budget for them to go back and photograph Great Wall a second time, a decade later, and they all disappeared. So I had to put my own project together, and I was able to get a small grant from Intel, and then I was able to turn all my other vendors in my budget into sponsors, and we went back and photographed Bloody Bay Wall in 2010, along with a team of scientists to document changes and study the changes, and a film crew to do a documentary about it. So in 2010, in July of 2010, well, actually, earlier in the year, I got to, because I had a budget for this now, I got to play with some more equipment. I had developed this kind of static piece of equipment that was like a framer that you put on an Iconos camera to take close-ups, only it was big. And that's how I built this first rig. But I ran into some problems with it, like it needed to be a little bit more versatile. A current could send me parasailing. So I spent about 8 months of little engineering time, and I built a new camera system. And this one had 8 thrusters on it. So I did 2 things. One, I could drive it, because I always wanted to drive it. It's always deploring. It's really bad feeling to be kicking as hard as you can and still be going backwards. So this one I can actually drive to where I'm going to use it, and it has a computer stabilization system on it that senses the attitude of the vehicle, and it uses these thrusters to maintain its position in water. So I can set it up somewhere, and it helps me try to keep the platform level while I'm taking these exposures. Now, or I can set it at an angle, and it will keep that angle. So it assisted me in doing this. I sent a whole bunch of equipment down with me. And this was we did 2 trips, one in July with the documentary crew. We had the producer of the series Sunrise Earth from Discovery HD got a contract from the World Ocean Observatory to produce a short film about this. They're going to show the film here, too. So we did 1 trip, and this was our documentary crew. And that gave me an opportunity to test the new device and all the methodology I was going to use to make the new image, and gave an opportunity to shoot all of the things for the film. Then we went back the next month to do the real thing, and this was the crew of people that worked with me there. Basically, I had an assistant that was there on the island that helped me do all the photography, and then a crew from Intel that had been sent by Intel to do another documentary, and then all of the crew of the boats that worked with us and dive masters. And this is us heading down the wall with our equipment. You can see how sheer of a wall this is. It's really just straight down, and it goes down thousands of feet. So it's like being over the edge of the Grand Canyon. You look down and you can't see anything but water. And basically we went down this 90 feet every day to set up and shoot this image. This is me cruising along in my new automobile. This is us working on the wall. You don't see everything because I had a lot of sponsors and they all wanted to send somebody. So I had a big crew. They all had to do something. So there are people up top that are doing things and helping me move my translation lines. Ocean Technology Systems provided our communications, and one of their reps came with us, and he was our safety diver, was watching everything that we do. So we had a lot of people to help us with safety and operations and make a really smooth project out of it. This is where you can see how close I am to the wall. I'm an inch away from the wall. So I'm basically shooting every frame here along basically a plumb line, and I'm shooting it at a distance of 3.5 feet. So every exposure is the same distance, 3.5 feet. There's another shot where you can see how close I am to the wall. I had a lot more leeway this time around. I wasn't as pressed on time, and one of the things I was able to do is shoot a lot more marine life there. So there's a lot more of the indigenous marine life that would normally be found on this wall that's actually included in the image because we had the luxury of spending more time to shoot it. In the end, this is the 2010 image of Great Wall West, which at first glance looks a whole lot like the last one, other than the fact that there's different marine life. And if I look at this image, I notice right away all the sponges and things that I have recognized over the years that are different because I visited the site probably at least once and maybe two or three times every year. So I can tell when a sponge is missing or something's really changed. But generally, the reef wall has remained healthy, and the distribution is just a little different of things. The scientists themselves are looking for things like coral coverage and percentage of this or that on the reef that they're just quantitatively documenting and comparing. If we were to look at this last image, just to give you an idea, if you look in the lower corner of the image here, this is what that looks like zoomed in. And this isn't life size. Well, maybe on the screen it is. On the screen, that's about life size. It's pretty close. So that's the kind of resolution that this whole image, if you can imagine that scene stretched 70 feet. When we look at the images from 1999 versus 2010 compared, you can see things like you can see the growth rate of sponges, very simply. Almost everything on this wall happens to be a sponge, so there's lots of this material to look at. So you see these sponges that were baseball-sized in 2010 are now almost garbage can-sized. We saw a lot of examples where the reef topology changes because things like sheet corals just fall off or they get knocked off in storms. But they're basically hanging on a vertical surface, so eventually gravity gives way and these things change. So over a period of 3 years, these plate corals just disappeared completely, and now in 2010, they're growing back again, and they're bigger now. I just visited them last year. Things that were mature, like mature sponges that had already achieved their maximum size, just aged a little bit more. So you can see, and also you can see how things have been, in this case, in 2006, there was a storm that damaged this barrel sponge, and now it's healthy again. And of course, the biggest change that they're experiencing in this area right now is the arrival of an invasive species on the reef, an Indonesian Indo-Pacific species somehow has appeared in Caribbean waters in 2009, fall of 2009. They saw them for the first time. I had already been planning this project when that happened, and I thought, man, this is going to be one of the biggest changes. We have to make sure to photograph this. So two or three trips ahead of my photography trip, I made sure I went and tried to photograph a lionfish on Great Wall. Less than a year later, by the time we got to do the actual photography, there was no problem in finding a lionfish on Great Wall. There was more of a problem in keeping them out of the frames I didn't want. So that's their biggest life-changing event down there, is this invasive species, and they're still struggling with how to deal with that issue. Another really cool thing that I got involved with during that same project is the same group of scientists that was studying the reef walls at Little Cayman and using my images of Great Wall as a baseline has also worked with a lot of other groups who are studying different types of things in that same area, including a group that had been looking into coral fluorescence. And what they're trying to do is find new flavors of these fluorescent proteins that have become really important for medical research. With these fluorescent proteins, they're able to splice these into genes and study, use them to as markers to study different types of diseases. There's a list of something like 150 different color varieties of these fluorescent proteins that have been found in marine life. And this group of scientists that I was working with have found about 50 of those. So they got a little budget from the National Science Foundation and talked me into trying to photograph this whole reef in fluorescence, which was a big project on its own. It ended up, we did spend some time on that summer. This is what this reef wall looks like if you photograph it with the right type of excitation light and filters, where you're exciting the light with you're exciting the corals with a blue light of a specific frequency, and in return it's giving off a different color of light that comes back. Chlorophyll and other proteins are giving off orange and red light in the reef substrate, and that's the forms the reds that you see here. We ended up having to come back and finish this off in a separate trip. It was a good thing because along the way we found some really interesting things, like this little eel that swam into our frame which we didn't even notice, and it turns out that this is is sporting green fluorescent protein, and nobody knew that before. This is what a portion of this whole image looks like. So this is a really wide area. It's not the whole image. I did do the whole image. But this is, what's significant about this is the National Science Foundation money was really to form an exhibit that is now touring in this Creatures of Light exhibit, which is all about biofluorescence and bioluminescence. And this is an exhibit that is right in the center of that larger exhibit, and it's all about coral fluorescence. And they've used a couple of images that I produced. One is the white light version of this image, and one is this fluorescence version. And out of that, they've created a kiosk somewhere that you can switch back and forth, and you can identify an area of interest, and on this little iPad controller, you can move that area of interest around, and then you can see what something looks like under white light or when it fluoresces. And that's a traveling exhibit that's now at the Field Museum and is going to be traveling to 6 or 8 other venues over the next 8 years. Another really great project that I was fortunate enough to be involved with was the Nassau Grouper Spawning Aggregation in Little Cayman last year. And I was invited by Reef and the Department of Environment on Grand Cayman to photograph this event. This is a really significant event there in the islands because they're fishing the species out of existence. But there are still, on these little islands, there's enough protected areas that this is now the largest spawning aggregation of Nassau groupers anywhere in the Caribbean on a tiny, tiny little island. And the real significance is that these groupers are very territorial, generally, and they spread out around the entire island. But every year, at the right time, in the right place, under the right moon, all of them get together for a party. And 4,000 to 6,000 groupers all congregate in one place. So this is significant for science, but it's also really significant because the fishermen found out first. And in 2003, I think it was, they fished one of these sites and took over half the grouper population all in one shot. And then most of those rotted because they couldn't actually deliver them to market. So part of this interest was to try to capture some wide-angle views that help you experience what this is like, along with some really good scientific information, public outreach that will convince people that maybe they shouldn't actually just fish their entire population in one day. But we haven't got to the point of showing these images around yet because half the political environment there is still pro-fishing, and they're worried that if they show this image, for example, people will say, look at how many fish are still there. We don't really have a problem. But well, my purpose there was to try to create these really wide images that you can't do with one picture to kind of capture the environment of what it's like when 4,000 groupers get together. And I was able to do that both during the day when they're just aggregating and also at night when they're spawning. This is what it looks like if you're actually swimming in that. This is the point where you're glad they're not carnivorous. And I was able to utilize the tiled monitor array at the University of California to preview these images. And we're working on coming up with a plan for how to use some kind of a display like this or how to present these images to the public in a way that will accomplish that outreach message. But that's still off in the future. So that was last year up until about February. And then I got this call that talked about this project. And this one is the one that scared me. I'd always wanted to do this. For all the reasons I just said, but I really didn't know for sure how I was going to go about it. So we actually didn't start this project until July, and I hopped on the first boat that I could find going to San Clemente and went out and did some tests. I had some areas in my mind that I thought would be good, but really the thing that really made the difference was going out and doing some tests, and I needed to come up with a way to shoot this image in a way that I was going to be able to make this work. So I had multiple components of this image. One is I need to capture all these really huge, high kelp plants that would be in my foreground, and I wanted to light them up and show off the detail and resolution of that. And I had to balance that with all these background areas that covered a really, really wide range. So out of that little trip, I came up with kind of a baseline plan, basically how I would shoot the background areas separate from the midfield areas from the foreground areas. And we launched into a project to go out and collect this imagery, which sounds easier than it is. We dove Channel Islands for about 2 months with pretty much every trip that I could find going out there. We didn't have a big enough budget to just charter a boat the whole time, so I got on commercial trips that were already going to locations, and I just kept diving every location we could find, hoping the best. Throughout that, we dove every island in the Channel Islands group except Santa Rosa. We dove Los Coronados in Mexico and Cortez Bank and Tanner Bank out here, which are just traditional fishing sites, but they're also dive locations. They're just out 100 miles offshore and out in the open ocean. Along the way, did all kinds of neat photography and saw pretty much everything the Channel Islands has to offer. But what we were really trying to do was find these special areas where the goal for me was to find the right combination of special water. For some reason, Vicky could never see any sea lions. I had an assistant that came out with me. She always come back and say, "Did you see any sea lions?" So along the way, I'm shooting bits and pieces of everything, thinking I might have to piece all of this imagery together from anything that I could shoot anywhere, because we're looking for the right conditions. And you know, one dive is different from the next, and one location is different from the next. And very often, you can't shoot the same location over and over and over and over again. But out of this whole trip, we're very, very fortunate in that we kept going back to areas that I wanted to work in San Clemente. And during that time, over that whole period, we ended up with just a couple really magical days on a site that wasn't the site that I had picked out, but it worked just as well. And you know, along the way, it's too bad that we just can't cover all the windows here. So we have more stuff. Spending time in the ocean is always rewarding, because you always see things you didn't plan to see. And very typically, you come across things you didn't really know existed. So that's always exciting. But in the end, we found some areas where I wanted to work, near where I wanted to work in San Clemente, that were just magical in this time. So these are the images that went into making this at a site in San Clemente, where we really weren't supposed to be at the time, I think. But the way this was done basically, is I've divided the sections of this image into three different parts: the background, the middle ground, and the foreground. The background, I'm shooting all with available light. So I have a whole series of images that I've collected over and over and over from all these different sites, but most importantly from this one site, which are the background images, which has been shot with vertical images that overlap to make a horizontal mosaic. So we have, say, 20 or 30 of these background images shot in the same site that have been put together in this fashion. They're all shot with available light. They're all put together with overlapping horizontal images. They all have a certain resolution, but that resolution really is driven by the water rather than the camera. So it's as high a resolution as it could be, and it covers that whole area. And then I'm photographing kelp in the foreground. So the idea is we're standing in a place where this wall of kelp is in front of us. And in one case, I've moved to the foreground ahead of those first kelp plants, and I'm photographing the background. Now I'm stepping back and I'm photographing these individual kelp plants as close as I need to be to produce full resolution, as sharp as I could be, which is about a foot and a half to 2 feet from the kelp plant. And so I'm taking this image and I'm working my way up with about 50% overlap all the way up this kelp plant until I've created an image that ultimately gets stitched together, and the end result of this is an image that's about 20,000 pixels high by about 7,000 pixels wide. And I do this over and over and over again for every plant that's there in the foreground. So now I've got maybe 20 or 30 foreground images like this, and maybe 20 or 30 of those background images. And this is an example of what those foreground kelp images look like. Each one of these is made from, each one of these is generally the full width of the camera I'm using, which is 7,300 pixels, or thereabouts, and as many overlapping frames as it took to make. And what I'm doing is I'm photographing each one with a lot of overlap, and I'm working my way up, and then I come back down again, and in most cases, I'm doing that again. So I end up with multiple sets of the imagery that ends up going together to make one vertical image. So now I've got 20 or 30 of these, and 20 or 30 of those background images, And then I have a whole series of midfield images. All of those end up getting composited together to form the final image. So along the way, everything doesn't result in the final project. So along the way, I have a lot of standalone images that are just ancillary, that were made in the same way, but aren't part of this actual image. So this gives you an example of what one of those completed images looks like. And these are just lower, smaller scale images done with the same technique. Now we're getting in. Now that these are the final composite images. So I've taken here, I've taken the image that went into this window, I've divided it into about four scenes here. And I added a fish or two. I was asked not to add too many fish because they didn't want this to compete with the aquarium. They don't want everybody to stand outside and not come in. So that's pretty much the whole thing, only seeing it in four pieces. This is the whole thing, as if you were walking along the outside of the building, looking at it from left to right. It actually takes a while to pan across it. I couldn't figure out how fast I wanted to walk. If I only walk this fast, it still takes 2 minutes to get across this whole image. And I thought, well, I'm probably not walking fast. That's too fast. But I didn't want to spend 5 minutes doing this. So if you go outside and look at it, walk fast. Then it will look like this. Because now we're only halfway through. We haven't even made it to the gift shop. So now when you pan across it like this, it gives you an idea how long this format is.
Where's the digital now?
This is all done digital.
Yeah.
Have to. This one would not have, this could not have taken place without. I'd still be working on the first few frames. One of the advents of digital photography that has made projects like this possible is the fact that in the old days, we'd take down a roll of film. So you get 36 exposures. You don't really get 36 exposures because you're not going to get to see the film until you get back from your trip and get it processed, so you get a bracket. So you take two or three or maybe four exposures for each one. So you're doing great if you get 9 shots on a dive. So there we've gone through the whole thing. In this case, a lot of these dives, I shot maybe 300 or 400 images on a dive. That, and like I said, these is really 4 dives that went into that hole. It took 2 months to get there, but those 4 dives produced 1,200 images that went into this image. And I did get the opportunity there to preview this image also at UCSD, which was a really fabulous thing because they gave us another step before going to the glass. We got to see it at actual size at full resolution, which was a lot of fun. And that's what I did on my summer vacation, and the rest was up to them. So about November-ish, they started manufacturing the glass. They used a glass company in LA that manufactured every part of this glass. They have the equipment to bend the glass into the right radius, and then they print the images and sandwich and laminate them inside of the glass, and then they cook it in a big oven, and it all goes together and comes out one big solid piece like this. So this is one of the windows that they did first as a test, and then manufactured all of them. And here they're installing the windows in place. This was happening in late November or early December, something like that. So this is what it looked like when they're just putting these windows up when the gift shop extension there was still fresh and unfinished. And now there it's all finished. And luckily, you guys get to go out and see it. Totally finished. I know him. Thank you very much.